Part 1. The System. 1. Force-fed eggs.
She put it in my mouth. I cried and spit it out. Then she did it again.
Rainy.
My Chinese uncle told me luck must have been falling from the sky the day I received the news. My son had been accepted into Shanghai's most prestigious kindergarten.
How did you get Rainy into Sung Ching Ling?
He asked. In other words, how had I, his American niece, succeeded where he'd come up short? His granddaughter was 3, just like Rainy, but she'd been denied a spot. Uncle Quang Guo had been an executive at one of China's first auto supply companies and for much of his life had enjoyed Guanxi, networks of people he could call on for favors and introductions. He'd had connections of the sort that made the impossible materialize on your doorstep.
Only luck, I suppose, I told him, as he wrinkled his nose at the floor.
We'd moved to Shanghai from Los Angeles in the summer of 2010, when Rainy was 18 months old. As we announced plans to move, I was surprised to detect an undercurrent of envy in our American friends' responses, as if we'd hopped a speedboat to China and they'd soon be treading water in our cultural and economic wake. Certainly, America's future seemed increasingly unstable. In the year 2010, the U.S. economy was still spinning inside a recession, while China seemed to be eating the planet's economic lunch. China boasted the world's fastest-growing major economy, the biggest market for autos, the largest number of cell phone users. A new superlative seemed to scroll across Western media headlines every other week. Within a decade or so, experts said, China would surpass the United States to become the largest economy in the world. We'd also been feeling the intense pressure of raising kids in a competitive urban environment. More and more, talk at dinner parties had begun to revolve around how to line up interviews for the few spots available at good American preschools, or the odds of winning that charter school lottery. The decision to relocate seemed easy. Rob had been offered a job as the China correspondent for a U.S. public radio show just as we were closing in on the starting line of an American parenting rat race.
Rainy will be bilingual,
one friend mused with raised brows, as if it had suddenly struck him that a two-language toddler might help with those preschool interviews.
Nanny help is affordable in Asia, I hear, pondered a girlfriend, after she'd battled fiercely with her husband over daycare pickups that week.
Rob and I chose to live in Shanghai's former French Concession, a part of the city center known for its winding streets, from which narrow alleys wind and weave, populated with small shops and cafes and overhung with abundant green foliage. This section of the city was conceded to the French in 1849 but transferred back to China in the 1940s during World War II. In the century in between, the French had made their mark, establishing the concession with now historic buildings and luxuriant London plane trees. Here, the foreign population enmeshes with its Chinese neighbors, together creating ample demand for such Western delights as French baguettes, gourmet coffee, and fresh brie, alongside Chinese street delicacies such as scallion pancakes, pork buns, and taro cakes. East meets West, right outside our front door. We found everything we needed in our new city and made friends quickly. At first, Rainy was more likely to stick chopsticks in his ear than use them to eat. But he adjusted to his new surroundings too, picking up spoken Mandarin and acquiring a taste for pork dumplings. We hired a Chinese IE named Huang Rong to take care of Rainy while Rob and I worked, and they developed a close, playful bond. Rainy spoke Mandarin with Huang Rong during the daytime and English in the evenings with us, and he was soaking up new words in both languages.
How's Rainy's Chinese coming along?
Friends back home would ask with a smidge of envy.
Great, he's already counting to 30,
I'd boast.
He's perfectly bilingual.
As Rainy's third birthday approached, about a year into our time in Shanghai, he was getting restless at home. A bilingual nursery where he spent time each week changed teachers frequently, and I knew we needed a real preschool with competent administrators. We briefly considered a Western-style school, but tuition for international schools in Shanghai cost as much or more than an Ivy League university. Nothing short of insane for a child who couldn't yet wipe his own behind. More than that, we couldn't easily afford it. Many American companies covered school fees for their employees, but at the time we were on our own. Chinese schools are a relative bargain. In China, public schools are managed and funded by an authoritarian government inside a culture that prizes education. It's also common knowledge that Chinese schools are great with discipline, and I reveled in the idea that someone other than I might toil away daily to imbue our son with self-control and a respect for learning, delivering him home at 4 p.m. every weekday, a model citizen with manners. Rob wanted to raise our son bilingually. He had studied, lived, and worked on three continents, and learning a second and third language had served him well in his career. We'd heard stories of Chinese teachers who went overboard with authority and Communist Party propaganda seeping into the later school years, but we couldn't imagine this would be an issue in kindergarten. While we didn't know much about what Rainey's day-to-day experience might be like inside a Chinese school, we liked the big picture. We weren't alone in that thought. In major Western cities, Chinese nannies had become highly coveted, and Mandarin immersion schools were springing up throughout the suburbs. Friends in Minnesota wangled their way onto the board of one such school to boost their chance of securing entry for their daughter. "We got a spot!" they would rejoice after months of acrobatics and schmoozing. China was among the world's largest economies, and its mother tongue the most spoken language in the world. And to me, it was clear. Being conversant in this culture and country would only become more important. In Shanghai, we would have a chance to ensconce our child in a real Chinese school. In China, nonetheless, we would harumph to friends back home. Our first choice was two blocks from home. We'd often strolled past the gates of Songqingling Kindergarten during neighborhood walks. Few Chinese schools looked as stately as this one, with its black and gold wrought iron gates enclosing a sparkling green lawn. A bold government plaque declared the school a model kindergarten of the type that all others should aspire to. And in this country, government plaques were a serious business. The school's namesake was the wife of Sun Yat-sen, founder of the Kuomintang, which ruled China until the communist takeover in 1949. Song Qingling, the woman, went on to devote much of her life to issues of education and children's welfare, and in today's China, she is considered a saint. The school drew the children of ranking Communist Party officials and families with money and influence. A current Shanghai vice mayor sent his grandchild to Song Qingling, as did a number of other top-ranking city officials. This was significant because the offices of the Shanghai mayor and party secretary were famous for being rest stops on the highway to national office, producing current President Xi Jinping, former president Jiang Zemin, and former premier Zhu Rongji. Also at the school were the children of tech and security entrepreneurs, IT gurus, and investment magnates. These were families with power, money, and the luxury of choice in a country where, I implicitly understood, options are fewer for those without wealth and connections. Chinese parents who couldn't secure a spot vented their frustrations online. "Many people knock their heads broken against the sky trying to get in," wrote one, using a common Chinese saying. "My child didn't get a seat. The world is full of unfair advantages. How will my son have a chance?" wrote another. Clearly, we'd sought a respite from the American parenting rat race, only to land squarely in the Chinese equivalent. When I peeped through the school's gates, I imagined the future leaders of China sitting inside its classrooms, being drilled in Mandarin characters, eating noodles and rice, and napping on canvas cots. If China's leadership trusts their offspring to the school, I thought, it must certainly be the best early education experience the country has to offer. Rainey's feelings about Songqingling were simpler.
"I like the playground," he said,
tiny hands gripping the black bars of the school gates, peering at the two climbing structures that stretched 20 feet skyward with tiny notches in each post for little feet. The school's classrooms encircled the play structures, and around 4 p.m. each day, young Chinese children spilled out into the green courtyard, their chatter filling the air with merriment.
Fang Shuela!
School's out.
Mama Dola!
I see Mom.
Hui Chala!
Time to go home. There was an element of order as the children covered every part of the lawn, eventually filing through the school's gates with a nod to the security guards.
Shu shu zai jian!
Goodbye, uncle, the kids would chirp, using a term reserved for addressing Chinese elders. Rainy glanced up at me, eyes wide.
Is this my school, Mommy?
Not sure yet, sweetheart. We'll see. We'd been preparing him for the transition from days at home. Little boys go to school every day, just like mommies or daddies go to work, we told him. Rob and I had strategized for months about how to get a spot for Rainey. Most public schools were required to admit students based on where they live, but the government allowed certain schools, particularly model and high-performing schools, to operate by special rules. The Chinese often gained admission to such schools through a complicated web of guanxi. But as foreigners, we'd need to find an alternative way in. During the year before Rainey would enter Xiaoban, the small class grade level that is officially the first year of kindergarten, we called the main office again and again. Rob and I took turns, carefully spacing out our calls by weeks, hoping they wouldn't remember our voices from previous failed inquiries. Each call was met with the same detached voice, giving us some variation of the same answer. Our classes are full. There's no reason to call again. There's no hope for a spot. We asked to speak with the principal and were always told, she's away at a meeting. One time, I managed to get her name, Zhang Yuan Zhang, or Principal Zhang. We always had a backup in Shanghai's international schools, but as we neared summertime, I figured I had nothing to lose. One more time, I walked over to the school entrance. I peered into the guardhouse, enclosed in glass and set just behind the black iron entrance gates, in perfect position to detect intruders. In moments such as these, I'm always aware that I'm a special kind of foreigner. Mandarin was the language of my childhood home, as my parents had emigrated with their families from China to the United States via Taiwan decades before. But I was born and raised in America. Thus, I speak Mandarin with a hint of a Texas drawl and a vocabulary of California speak I cultivated as a young adult. To most mainland Chinese, I appeared to be one of them until I opened my mouth, and they'd quickly identify me as someone deserving of unique disdain, an alien cousin who spoke oddly and had foreign mannerisms. I waved at the guardhouse glass. One of two men sitting inside ventured out.
What do you want?
He barked through the gates. He was a short man, coming up only to my shoulder, and he wore thick glasses. Is Zhang Yuan Zhang in? I said.
What are you inquiring about?
Just wondering about a spot for my son. He looked me over and then shook his head.
It's full. It's always full, he said. There's no use in asking.
May I speak with her? I'd just like to introduce myself.
She's in a meeting. The guard responded.
He turned and stepped back into the glass-enclosed house.
When is a better time to come back?
I called after him, but he ignored me. Later, at home, Rob and I regrouped.
Should I go?
Rob asked. I think you might have to, I replied.
Yep,
Rob said, looking at me meaningfully. That was the reality in China. Sometimes you needed to send over the foreigner. I spent my first year in China bemoaning this reality, as a strong-headed woman who managed the finances in her marriage. But here was a culture with an ingrained hierarchy about who matters and who doesn't. Caucasian Americans trump Chinese Americans. And on top of that, Rob was a fluent Mandarin speaker who'd spent time in rural China. He was a source of unusual fascination for the Chinese, and he typically managed to sneak in a request while they wallowed in wonderment at this blonde, blue-eyed foreigner who spoke their language. Rob walked over to the school gates before work one day and triumphantly reported that evening that he'd managed to get the guard to call a teacher out to meet him.
She was friendly, Rob reported. She said, You speak Chinese so well. Then she wrote Rainey's name and passport number down on a piece of paper.
Did she write it down in some kind of notebook? I prodded. Did it look like a waiting list?
No. It was a scrap of paper. The size of a post-it,
Rob said, with some hesitation. She didn't invite you inside? I pressed, my pride assuaged by the fact that he too had failed to penetrate the gates.
Nope.
Rob raised his eyebrows. He knew exactly what was going on inside my head. Even so, we rejoiced. Somewhere inside that formidable institution, our son's name was sitting on a slip of paper that might eventually find its way to Principal Zhang. Now we could only wait. A month later, a call came to my mobile phone. The vice principal introduced herself as she.
You're lucky, she said brusquely. We are allowed to add a few spots to the Xiaoban grade level. Has Rainey found a school yet?
No, we'd love for him to go to Sung Qingling, I said quickly.
Bring him over next week.
On the day of our interview, I dressed Rainey in a plaid shirt and corduroy pants and served his favorite breakfast of oatmeal and apples. Rob was traveling for work, and my father happened to be in town for a visit, so I decided to bring him along as backup. I planned to present to Principal Zhang the portrait of an ideal Sung Qingling family. Captivatingly cute toddler, engaging Mandarin-speaking foreigner parent, and one talkative grandfather with deep roots in the country. Rainey said,
Ni hao,
when he was supposed to say hello. I hit my Mandarin tones perfectly, and my father became fast friends with Vice Principal Xi, who marveled that here was a Shanghai-born Chinese man who raised a family in the United States,
while decades later his American-born daughter was rearing a family in the motherland.
Whether by chance or circumstance, a family had gone on a long journey and returned to the bosom of the motherland. Now, its members were kowtowing to Vice Principal Xi.
And Rainey has the opportunity to attend Sung Qingling, she said, perhaps pondering the smallness of the globe or the circular nature of life.
Yes, we hope so,
my father smiled.
Qian ren zhong shu, hou ren qiang liang,
she remarked, shaking her head. One generation plants the trees, another gets the shade. That was it, the moment I knew we were in. A Chinese proverb uttered in conversation indicated wonderment, camaraderie, and acceptance all rolled into one. It was always a splendid surprise, like a tissue-wrapped mooncake dropping suddenly out of the sky. Principal Zhang, who had hovered nearby during most of our meeting, delivered a short nod at Xi before stepping out of the room.
So Rainey's in? My father asked Xi.
Yes. Xi gave a firm nod. At home, Rob and I marveled at our good fortune. Rainey had a spot in school, and we couldn't be more thrilled. It was Rainey's first day of school. Rob and I made our way through the crowds that thronged the streets of the French Concession on this lovely fall morning. Between us, like a tiny bud on a daisy chain, was Rainey, each hand clasping one of ours. As Rob and I took a step forward, Rainey pulled us backward, tugging with all his might. Suddenly, Rainey stopped.
I'm going to cry, he announced.
It's okay to cry, I assured him, dragging him forward. Slowed by our hand-holding, our little ensemble weaved its way north up the crowded sidewalks of Wulumuqi Road and waited out a red light as taxis, sedans, and scooters choked and gasped on the morning commute.
Let's not cut through the hospital,
Rob called out. We passed a bustling hospital complex, whose outpatient department alone serves more than 4 million patients a year, and veered left onto Hong Kou Road. As we approached the school, we stepped in front of a Ferrari and around the tail of a BMW with a driver inside, assisting with morning drop-offs. In the Sung Qingling crowd, Rob and I were distinctly middle class, but we were foreign, and that was our mark. Indeed, Rainey was the perfect manifestation of West and East.
He had my husband's lanky figure and high-bridged Caucasian nose, and the dark hair and black-brown eyes of my Chinese heritage. His round eyes were so large, they overtook most of the real estate on his face. The effect was that he looked continually awestruck. Old Chinese men and young professional women alike would stare down at him, exclaiming, "Look at that little foreigner! He's a handsome little guy!" We streamed through the wrought iron gates along with other sets of parents and grandparents, as the elders issued missives in Chinese. "Behave. Listen to the teacher. Eat your vegetables." Song Qingling divided its classes into four grade levels: caring, small, middle, and big, and further divided each level into classroom numbers. That made 20 classes total spanning the ages of 2 to 6 years old. Rainey's home for the next year would be small class number 4. Parents and grandparents crowded the classroom doorway, packed 4 or 5 deep. Over their heads, I saw the face of Teacher Chen, master instructor of small class number 4. She had yellowed teeth with black marks where they touched. And despite her smile, my gaze always seemed to home in on those dark spots. I instinctively gathered there was nothing small about her temper. Today, Chen was friendly, patting children's heads and fluidly greeting parents in either Mandarin or Shanghainese. "Welcome to school. Did you have a nice summer?" She intuitively knew which language to use. The children seemed calm and compliant, issuing a nod or chirping a hello. In China, you don't so much as push your way forward as let the crowd carry you. As we were slowly transported to the doorframe, Rainey gripped my hand tighter and tighter. Parents peeled away, and we finally found ourselves at the door, facing Teacher Chen. I nodded at her, adjusted Rainey's shirt, and gave him a reassuring pat on his head. "We love you, Rainey. We'll see you after school."
"No, don't leave me,"
Rainey said in English, glancing up at me frantically as Rob and I pushed back toward the stairwell.
"Don't leave me here."
Tears began flowing. I sidestepped over to the exit, and in a flash, Rainey went horizontal, throwing himself at my ankles. "We'll see you later today," I said, looking down at the back of Rainey's head, trying to stay calm. "You'll have fun at school. See all the toys?" I looked around. Pale green streamers hung from the ceiling at evenly spaced intervals, and a row of paper plates with flower petal cutouts greeted us along the back wall. Color drawings from the previous year's class were still up. I noticed that all the apple trees were colored in the same way, with scribbles and shades of green, brown, and red.
"Go have a snack. Be a good boy. Tinghua," said Teacher Chen. "Listen to what I say."
It was the listen and obey command that would become a theme of Rainey's time here.
"No!"
Rainey sobbed, speaking to my ankles as Chinese parents looked on with great interest. It seemed their children were silent, standing tall and filing into the classroom, spines erect.
"Don't go! Don't leave me!"
Rainey screamed. Rob leaned over, detached Rainey from my ankles, and carried him into the classroom. He deposited our 30-pound boy near the play kitchen, turned, and sprinted toward the doorway, next to which several children sat at tables, quietly drinking milk and chomping sugar cookies. Cookies at 8 a.m.? And glancing our way with interest. Rob and I pushed through the crowd of parents and children and ran down the stairs. We stopped once we were safely out of sight. I turned my ears in the direction of the classroom door, hoping to hear silence. The stealth listening familiar to any parent doing a daycare or school drop-off. Rainey was still wailing. We listened for about 30 seconds, and I suddenly noticed I was grinding my teeth. Rob turned to me.
"Welcome to Song Qingling," he said, with an uncertain smile.
He grabbed my hand and we made our way toward the school's gates. The second day of school, Rainey came home with a story. 4 times, he found egg in his mouth. He hadn't placed it there himself. Instead, His most hated food made its way past his teeth by the hand of the fearsome teacher Chen.
She put it there,
Rainey told me, mouth wide, finger pointing inside. Then what happened? I asked.
I cried and spit it out.
Then what?
She did it again,
Rainey said. We were making our way home along a crowded sidewalk jammed with people and lined with fruit and vegetable vendors. Rainey jabbed an elbow into the bottom of an elderly Chinese woman walking before us, pushed firmly, and stepped into the void he'd created. Our little boy could throw elbows like the natives. And? I prodded.
I cried and spit it out again, he said.
I coaxed more of the story out of him. Teacher Chen had put egg in his mouth 4 times, and the last time he swallowed. I absorbed the news of my child being force-fed in school, the clamor of China surrounding us, the bleats of a vendor hawking tomatoes on a 3-wheeled cart, the creak of a turnstile halfway down a neighborhood lane, the sounds of taxi horns. At home, battles over food ended in screaming and flailing. Rainey would rather go hungry than try something new. The last time I'd presented him with steamed kale, which I arranged in dinosaur shape on his plate, he thrashed so violently that he chipped a tooth against the floor. Why did you eat the egg? I asked.
I don't want to talk anymore.
Later, I texted an American girlfriend, thumbs flying over my phone. I think Rainey was force-fed eggs in school. My friend responded without missing a beat. I think the severe discipline of the Chinese teaching style is oppressive. You're not going to find Mary Poppins here, but forcing a smart, free-thinking child to eat an egg is disturbing. Her children attended an international school in Shanghai. I resolved to ask Teacher Chen about it at pickup time. I didn't entirely trust my 3-year-old's account of what happened, and I thought it would be a great time to introduce myself as an engaged and involved parent. The next day, I lined up with the crowd, mostly mothers and grandparents, outside the classroom door and strained to lift my head above the throng. I got a glimpse of 30 children sitting in pint-sized chairs in a perfect U-shaped formation around the teacher. Rainey was sitting, in the 3rd chair from one end. He rarely sat at home, and I saw here that it wasn't easy for him. Every appendage was in motion, elbows, hands, legs, feet. He looked like a wiggly caterpillar with its middle nailed down and the rest flailing wildly, but still he kept his seat. Craning his neck toward the door, along with every other child awaiting pickup, Rainey finally spotted me. The teacher saw me also and called his name. Rainey sprang from his seat and ran over to me. One by one, the other children's names were called. Parents peeled away. And finally, I could step over to Teacher Chen. Rainey clutched my hand. Good afternoon, Teacher Chen, I said. We're excited to start the new year.
Good, good, Chen responded.
How's Rainey doing?
Good, Chen said, nodding.
I wanted to ask something. Rainey doesn't eat eggs at home, but he told me he ate them at school. Did someone put eggs in Rainey's mouth?
Yes,
she answered, without a smidgen of defensiveness. My heart jumped, and any plan to ease into this conversation evaporated. I forged ahead.
Really? Who?
I did, Chen said.
We prefer you don't make Rainey eat foods he doesn't like. We foreigners don't use these methods, I said, as Teacher Chen tapped her foot and glanced past me.
We don't use such methods of force in America, I repeated.
Oh, how do you do it?
She clucked, looking down at Rainey.
We explain that eating egg is good for them, that the nutrients help build strong bones and teeth and helps with eyesight, I said, words speeding up as I tried to sound authoritative. We motivate them to choose to eat eggs. We trust them with a decision.
Does it work? Chen said.
An image of Rainey's chipped tooth flashed before my eyes.
Well, not always,
I admitted. Chen nodded. Rainy needs to eat eggs. We think eggs are good nutrition, and all young children must eat them.
She took one last look at Rainy and then clicked away.
There's a little man who resides inside the head of every Chinese man and woman, whether they know it or not. He governs how they find their mates, what they look for in jobs, how they treat their parents, and how they educate their children. His name is Confucius, and he lived 2,500 years ago. He was both a teacher and a philosopher. You mention his name, Kongzi, to most ordinary Chinese, and they nod in respect and then change the subject, as if he's some great-great-granduncle they know they're supposed to revere but don't have much to say about. Confucius believed that the purpose of education was to shape every person into a harmonious member of society, and harmony was more easily maintained if everyone knew his proper place. So Confucius spent a lot of time and attention delineating relationships. In Confucius's world, a wife always obeys her husband. A subject never challenges his emperor. A young brother heeds the older brother. And a son does what his father requires on a daily basis. Let the ruler be a ruler. The subject a subject. The father a father. The son a son, Confucius said, according to the Analects, a classic collection of ideas attributed to him and his followers. Confucius staked his entire philosophical pantheon on the concept of top-down authority and bottom-up obedience. I remember these lessons from my own upbringing. My father grew up in Asia and brought his Chinese ways to America, where he met and married my mother, like him a fellow Chinese immigrant, and raised my sister and me. My father was nothing if not authoritarian, and I had a rebellious streak, setting the stage for many clashes during my childhood. In our suburban Houston mid-century house sat a preserved portion of a tree that had grown in the yard of my father's childhood home in Taiwan. Knotted where branches used to grow and slicked over with polyurethane, the section of trunk served as a gnarled, daily reminder of ancient traditions. I was constantly overstepping boundaries. I don't want to do homework tonight. I'm tired of chemistry. You make me study too hard, I'd say to my father, whom I called Ba, the Chinese word for father.
A daughter is not supposed to talk to her father like that, he'd retort, lips quivering with rage.
As a teenager, I never knew who had told him daughters don't talk like that. But now I know it was Confucius whispering his wisdom across the generations and reaching down into our lives. Another time, I coolly informed my father that I was plotting to audition for the drill team, a venerable institution at a top high school, Texas state champs in 78, inside a state that worships football. Unfortunately, football and dance don't register as a worthy pastime on the Chinese scale.
Dance is not an honors elective, Ba said. It will bring down your grade point average.
I don't care. I'm going for it anyway, I told him.
Oh, Ba said. You can just decide like that?
Yeah, I'm going to do it. And there's nothing you can do about it.
I remember there was nothing more satisfying and terrifying than challenging my father's authority. That was also me butting up against Confucius.
Every year, my mother and aunt, my father's sister, would spend days preparing dishes for our annual Chinese New Year feast. They'd shell shrimp, chop pork, braise mushrooms, boil winter melons for soup, roast ducks, wrap dumplings, and on and on. At the end of the long labor, we would place the dishes, sometimes 24 in all, on a table alongside burning incense as a way to honor our ancestors. After an hour or two, the smoky, sweet smell of incense would pervade the house, while the food turned limp, with stir-fry oil forming shiny pools on the plates. We'd have to reheat each dish one by one in the microwave before we could finally sit down to enjoy our feast. The year I was 10, I announced that this ritual not only seemed inefficient, but was a grand waste of feminine labor.
We must honor our ancestors,
my father countered, launching into a speech about tradition. The lecture, a familiar one by this time, would take 15 minutes, but boiled down to the promise that misfortune would befall those who didn't honor their ancestors properly. According to the Confucian canon, an event that seemed like bad luck, an accident, a lost job, was really an ancestor's revenge. And so the women of the family continued the annual shell chop, braise, boil, roast, wrap marathon, and we continued to let the food sit on a table for hours afterward. I was a terrible practitioner of filial piety. This is one of the concepts Confucius espoused most heavily, and it called for children to respect their elders as well as folks who'd given rise to their bloodline but were long gone from this earth. While in the West, elders often retire to nursing homes when health turns frail, the Chinese buy homes with a spare bedroom for grandma and spend days preparing feasts to honor her after she's gone. Ancient paintings and verse illustrate how the virtue of filial piety knows no bounds. A young boy encourages mosquitoes to suck his blood so that his parents will remain undisturbed while they slept. A man buries his infant son alive to free up scarce foodstuffs for his ailing mother. A man tastes his father's stool to diagnose a terminal illness and then offers up his life in exchange. My favorite is about a woman and her mother-in-law, a figure much maligned in Western culture. Not so in China. In one tale, a woman cut out a piece of her own liver to boil as a base for broth to cure her severely ill mother-in-law. In today's China, filial piety often manifests itself in the form of educational achievement. Performing well in school is the ultimate way to respect your parents, since good grades and test scores are the path to financial stability, and the ability to provide for your parents and buy a bigger house, with a room for grandma. The principle of obedience and respect extends naturally to teachers, of course, as children are required to respect the teacher's authority without preconditions, wrote two Western academics in a 1996 study of Chinese kindergarten curricula. Parents are also required to fall into step. And so, I had crossed a line with Teacher Chen. I had failed yet again to be a proper practitioner of Confucianism. I sensed it the moment she chose to end our conversation about eggs with a simple maneuver. She walked away from me. Over the following weeks, she no longer engaged me, although I could see her glancing my way amidst the scrum of parents at pickup. On the day she asked me to step into the coat room, I realized she'd been waiting for an opportunity to talk privately. "Let me bother you for a second," Chen said, using a common nicety. "Sure, is there a problem?" "No problem, but I want you to refrain from questioning my methods in front of Rainey," she said. "Oh," I said. "Yes, it is better that the children think we are in agreement about everything," she said. "Oh," I said. "If you have a different opinion from me, then you can talk to me privately," she said. "But in front of the children, you should say, 'Teacher is right, and Mom will do things the same way.' Okay?" she said. "Oh, okay," I stammered. "I didn't mean, I just want him to be happy in school." "Happy? He is happy," she said, with a firm nod. "And at home, it's best also if you don't talk about the teachers when Rainey's in the room." Teacher Chen's mouth was upturned, in a taut smile of forced courtesy. Before I could reply, she admonished me once more. "Don't make the children feel Mom's opinion conflicts with the teachers." I nodded and quickly stepped out of the coat room. I'd been scolded by Teacher Chen. On my way home with Rainey, my mind raced to process the exchange. What I'd viewed as a simple request of Teacher Chen had been taken as an affront to her authority. The glimpse I'd had of Rainey sitting in a chair at pickup time, waiting for a teacher's permission to rise, suddenly seemed foreboding. Snippets of conversations I'd had with other Chinese parents filtered into my head. they suddenly had context. A Chinese mother had told me once she was afraid to ask her son's teacher about anything, for fear her child would suffer consequences in the classroom. Poor woman, I'd thought back then. Imagine that. Another parent had told me she spent weeks planning the gifts she'd bestow on her daughter's master teacher. Western skincare or luxury items were great, she said, enthusiastically ticking off brand names with a Chinese accent. Louis Vuitton, Prada, L'Occitane, Clinique, Godiva. She'd been tipping me off, I now realized. I'd failed these tests, and to top that off, I'd challenged a teacher in front of a child. A Chinese early childhood education professor would later tell me that the worst thing for a teacher is to lose face in front of children.
Westerners may feel happy when children challenge them, but in our traditional culture, we don't think life is supposed to be like this, he said.
The following weeks, Chen avoided me as much as possible. When I approached, she was always engaged with another parent or leaning over to talk to a child. Shanghai built its subways in just a few years, and a new building seemed to pop up in our neighborhood every month. Shanghai Tower was rising on the horizon, steel piece by steel piece, and when completed, it would be the world's tallest skyscraper, boasting the fastest elevator in existence. The country's economy was growing at unparalleled rates. But amidst all that change, some traditions were too ingrained to shift even an inch. You must be devoted to your elders, and you never questioned your teachers to their face. Today's rules of societal conduct had been cemented 2.5 millennia ago, and I had done the unthinkable. Rainey and I were in trouble. Over the next week, I began to watch others in the pickup line, keeping my head down as I approached the classroom door. Some yapped with Teacher Chen and Associate Teacher Tsai in their native Shanghainese, a language I didn't understand or speak, and others spoke in Mandarin about the children's artwork or after-school activities. The parents never seemed to voice any concerns or brave any inquiries about what the children were doing in school. The only questions I heard were open-ended and non-confrontational, innocuous. Did Nong Nong fall asleep quickly today at nap time? Did Mei Mei eat her lunch? All exchanges ended in some sort of nicety by the parents.
老师辛苦了.
Teacher, you work too hard. What a great job you're doing.
太棒.
Too amazing. Excellent. Okay, I get it, I told myself. Keep it light. Offer compliments. One day at pickup, Teacher Chen spoke to me. Rainey eats eggs. Her delivery was flat, as if she were ticking off a grade on a list of subjects. Her tone of voice clearly denoted B-, as in, the process was labored, but the goal was eventually reached.
太棒了!
I cried.
Excellent!
Inside my stomach was inside my throat. Eggs had taken on a new meaning in my life. They were no longer simply a good source of protein. I was anxious about eggs, and fearful of the methodology employed to get my son to swallow them. Safe inside our apartment walls, Rainey continued to refuse eggs, whether scrambled, fried, poached, or boiled. How did Chen manage it? And did he eat them willingly? By his own hand? These thoughts kept rolling over in my head, until I decided I needed to see Rainey eat an egg for myself. One weekend morning, I cajoled Rainey to have an egg, tossing in a helping of carbs and offering a bribe for good measure. Rainey, if you eat this French toast, you can watch Kung Fu Panda after breakfast, I said.
What's French toast? Does it have egg in it?
Egg clearly had special meaning for Rainey, too. Well, French toast is bread, with a little egg, I ventured. But mostly bread. Rainey glanced at the egg-coated creation I'd placed on a plate, thought about Kung Fu kicking pandas, and nodded. He asked for a cup of water, and I installed myself in a chair about 10 feet away, pretending to read a book. Rainey placed the plastic water cup at the 2 o'clock position, next to his plate. He looked at the arrangement for about half a minute. Then, deliberately, he started. His little fingers tore the French toast into small pieces, which he scattered about the plate. He eyed the pieces. He took a deep breath. He chose one and placed it in his mouth. Morsel in, he moved quickly, scooping up the cup of water and tipping it into his mouth, flushing the bit of French toast down his throat like a dinghy pressed through a tunnel by a tidal wave. He paused, took another breath, and repeated the process. I refilled his cup when empty. He was determined, and he didn't pause to speak or smile. 15 minutes and 3 cups of water later, the French toast had disappeared. I heard the voice of every American pediatric and nutritional expert from Mayo Clinic to Dr. Sears. Don't ignite food battles. Don't force food on children. Don't let mealtime become a source of anxiety. Food should be enjoyed, lest disordered eating develop in later life. It was safe to say I had accomplished all those no-nos in magnificent form. My promise of Kung Fu Panda was also a Western no-no. Never reward food consumption. Yet I was amazed. I'd never suspected my 3-year-old was capable of such a display of resolve. I barely recognized my tantrum-throwing, food-tossing, chipped-toothed little boy in this creature who'd willed himself to complete a task he did not enjoy. The culture reinforced the notion that teacher knows best. But did the end justify the means? After the plate was empty, Rainey settled in front of the television, Kung Fu Panda cartwheeling across the screen. Do the teachers watch you eat? I asked. Rainey paused, considering my query.
I'll tell you if you let me watch Thomas the Train, too.